You're in with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show on tntradio.live. And you can find me on my new Telegram channel, Dolores Cahill, and also on custodian.com. And I'm going to hand it over now to the host today, Kevin Corbett. And our joint guests today are Mike Stone and Eric Coppolino, and also Dr. Mark Bailey from New Zealand. Over to you, Kevin.
Thank you, Dolores. And we've heard in the first hour some really interesting data about the whole practice of virology going back to the 19th century. And most people, when you say this to them, you know, the whole area or discipline it's called of virology is groundless or is unscientific. It's very interesting, the response from lay people, scientists, quite varied. And I've tried to uncouple this and discover why over the last 2 years, why this situation arose historically. And there's a lot of work out there. There's a lot of scholarship to throw light on this. We've heard today from Dr. Mark Bailey, and who works with Dr. Sam Bailey in New Zealand. They've done a lot of work uncovering this. Eric Coppolino, investigative reporter in America, has done a lot of work on this. And so has Mike Stone with his virology.com website. I've put a lot of work out there over the years. I've done a lot of work on this, or tried to do, and through my website, kevinpcorbett.com, and my citizen science Telegram channel, Kevin Corbett, PhD. And looking at the science, the history of the science, I think is quite key here. And the history of how molecular biology arose from the 1920s onwards is very key to understanding where we are with all these issues today. And the development of molecular biology from biology was really a technology transfer from areas like chemistry and physics into biological sciences in the 1920s and 30s. And the biological sciences that were really focused on the material reality of organisms and their physical presence and their characterization became colonized with interests from the other scientists, sciences like physics and chemistry, where the shift became towards the abstract and the virtual. You saw this in the work in the 1930s on the bacteriophage that was led by Max Delbruck, who was a physicist who became a biophysicist later in life, but he was a quantum physicist in the 1920s and 30s, and brought into biology this focus on the bacteriophage and on abstracting this phenomenon into statistical variables that could be manipulated in all sorts of mathematical ways, which had very little to do with the biological reality of bacteriophages. I think this is quite key, this history, to what's happened today, where we've got this focus on genetic sequencing and genetic manipulation of so-called viruses, but no focus on their biological reality, their actual entities. And this is why I think the research of Christine Massey is quite key, because it's pointing a light on this area today in the 21st century. Our public health authorities and agencies like the CDC and the UK HSA are not interested in the biological entity of viruses. They don't have any physical samples of them. And is that because these things don't actually exist, or don't exist in the ways we've been told they exist? And I think this is key, going back to what happened in the 20s and 30s and looking at this work again, looking at the work of the bacteriophage scientists, looking at how they could not prove the infection model. They couldn't prove a pathogenic infective bacteriophage. And that was really key. So what they did was they used a lot of technology, they used a lot of mathematics, and they developed workarounds. They developed sort of ways of going around the observations that couldn't be explained by their model. So they're projecting into their data and their observations a whole imaginary model of an infective pathogenic virus. And it just did not fit. And when it didn't fit, they walked around that data, they walked around it, they developed workarounds. One area of this with the bacteriophage was where they could not prove that it infected bacteria. So they developed this concept called the eclipse phase. And this is another area where they also had to develop a workaround, was in the electron microscopy of bacteriophages, where they showed, looking at it ostensibly on paper, on the EMs, they said that these things had a head and they had a tail. And then after many years, one of the electron microscopists, Andrews, discovered that what they were looking at with the so-called tails of bacteriophages were just artifacts of the way these samples had been prepared for the microscopy slides. And this is an amazing discovery, that this was artifactual. And of course, this really lends itself to the work of Harold Hillman in the 1960s and 70s, who really underscored the whole of electron microscopy with many questions about what actually is it that they're looking at, and is what they're looking at artifactual? Are they artifacts of the way these things have been prepared and not actual structures, not actual entities? So again, this is bringing us back to the 21st century and the whole in silico modeling of viruses, this whole approach really that is technically driven, technologically driven. It's not driven by material biology, by the focus on the phenotype. It's focusing on genetic fragments and abstractions and virtual realities. And I do think that this is where we are with this. I do think an historical analysis is quite important here. So I'd like to bring back in some of our speakers from the first hour. Maybe you could pick up on this, Mark, with what you were saying earlier before the break, and we could then bring back in Mike and Eric.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, I think it is one concept that Eric's picked up on is this in silico world of virology. And I think very few people do understand what actually happens in the science of virology. There is what they call a wet lab pipeline, which is where they actually have the samples and process them. But these days they're so anxious to get them into the dry lab pipeline, which is the in silico world. It's almost like they don't care anymore. They just want the samples to come in. They want to process them through automated machines and then start to sequence what they can find. But I mean, most of us, we're not denying that they can't find these sequences from environmental samples. What we're saying is that the significance of them clinically and biologically is completely incorrect. So we've got these whole fields now of genomics and proteomics, which supposedly are very high-tech, very well-funded operations. But those of us that are actually looking into them and applying the scientific method are saying these don't tell you anything about health, disease, and well-being. And I think that's where the public are being completely misled. So one thing you might see is when one of us on the panel says that the virus doesn't exist, that they might say, well, I went to GenBank or GSAID and I see it's been found 12 million times. So how could that be wrong? And what we're saying is that they're just doing the same loop of the same track over and over again. So if you say that you've got some sequences that belong to a virus, and then other people go out and find the same sequences, because someone's already declared that they're a virus, everyone else thinks they're finding the virus too. What we're saying is we need to see a step where you show that there is a virus and that the sequences that you're finding come from inside the virus. And same with the proteins that can be detected. We need to see, well, we need to see a particle purified and characterized so that we know the proteins come from this particular virus. So this is, and this is the whole problem of how they create a fake epidemic, is that people think that the detection of these sequences through PCR and genomics, or detection of proteins through things like the antigen or lateral flow tests, mean that people are picking up the virus or being infected with the virus, when you don't need that at all. And I mean, it can be pointed out, probably the public can understand things like, we can perform a PCR on an orange or a dog or some environmental sample, a puddle that you find on your driveway. And all of these things can supposedly test positive. But what does that mean? That you've found some proteins or some genetic sequences? It means absolutely nothing. Yeah. So yes. What we see these days is inventions of epidemics through testing, basically. Yes. And when I say testing, yeah, I put that in quotes because they're not really tests as such. They're just molecular chemical reactions done in vitro, which have nothing to do with the health of a human or an animal.
Yes.
So
I think this, I think what you're saying there, Mark, is really important, because the application of these technologies in the public sphere lends credibility and legitimacy to the concept of the virus, when, as you're saying, it's the interpretation of those outcomes that's important. And I think this is also what you're saying is very important, that our critique is not an anti-science critique. Ours is a true scientific critique, because we're questioning and critiquing the methods by which they've arrived at these technologies, which is what Mike was saying earlier in terms of the lack of true research designs. And I do think that that's a very important thing to put out there. We are not anti-scientists. We are true scientists. We're saying that the scientific method hasn't been properly applied here at all. It hasn't even been applied in a rudimentary way. But these technologies, their licensing and fast tracking into health services, has given credence to the whole concept of the virus when it hasn't been proven to exist in the first place. So I think the technology's gone ahead of itself here, or rather the technology's gone ahead of the science. Would you agree then, Mark, with this?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that we do as citizen scientists, and both Sam and I do this, and Mike Stone on Virology does this as well, is that we don't start like most people do and say there's an epidemic and people are getting sick and there's a virus passing around. I mean, that's just something that a newspaper article can report without any scientific analysis whatsoever. So what we do is we follow scientific trails right back to the start. So if there's a claim that there is an entity called a coronavirus, we just don't accept that we get shown a picture and one or two scientific papers that claim that coronaviruses exist. We actually follow the trail right back as far as it will go. So with coronaviruses, that usually takes us back to the 1960s, when quite a few publications started to come out, through to the 1980s, when they claimed to sequence coronaviruses for the first time and get their entire genomes. But the thing is, when we've taken a deep dive into the literature, we've not found any evidence of viruses, because there'll be claims. There's one study that will just get piggybacked onto another study. And when you follow it all the way back to the start, we always find with every single virus, we get to the same problem, that the foundational papers do not show an infectious particle that is passing around and making people or other hosts sick. So the whole thing is fraudulent. Yeah. And it is difficult. And I would say to people, a lot of people listening to this stuff for the first time will be saying, but what about this? But what about measles? But what about chickenpox? And what you need to do in those situations is usually the best thing to do is go to Mike's website, Virology, or go to the Bailey's website, our website, which is drsambailey.com, because there are hundreds, I'm telling you, hundreds and hundreds of articles, videos, publications where we have covered all of this material before. So, yeah, so that's a really important thing, is to say that whenever you get presented with someone, with something like a claim that one of these viruses exists, whether it's HIV or SARS-CoV-2, you have to ask yourself, how do you know this? Is this, am I just, you know, repeating, parroting what everyone else is saying around me? And we're just saying, as you say, Kevin, we're just taking it from a scientific point of view and taking a deep dive into literature. Now, and one thing I know, Dolores, you get asked and we get asked too, is that if there is no virus, what on earth are the vaccines all about? Now, this is not a new problem with vaccines, because for any alleged viral entity, on this panel here, because we don't believe that there is such a thing as pathogenic viruses, our investigations into the literature have shown that all of these vaccinations that date right back to things like Jenner, the smallpox vaccine, the late 1700s and onwards, it's all a scientific scandal, basically, because they never showed that there was an infectious particle. They never showed that these conditions could actually pass between people. And I know for some people that sounds incredible, that contagion, which is promoted by the entire medical and pharmaceutical industries and is thought to be common wisdom, but in fact it's not. There is no evidence that this contagion takes place. So, yeah, the entire premise of vaccines is fraudulent. And with something like SARS-CoV-2, the mRNA vaccines are simply based on sequences that are said to be viral in origin, but our research has shown that they have not established that these sequences are viral in origin. For example, the spike protein, the sequences were described as early as 1990 with cell culture experiments. So these are not new. The spike protein is not a new thing. It has been described for the last 3 or 4 decades. What we would contest is that it does not come from an entity called a coronavirus. We have seen it in environmental specimens. We've seen it in tissue breakdown experiments where they've identified the proteins and genetic sequences that have been called spike proteins. Mm-hmm. And basically the vaccine is based on those. Are the genetic sequences real? Probably. Do they belong to a virus? No, that's never been shown.
Yes. Yeah. I think that that's a key issue that the truth movement, the freedom movement, don't understand. We're not questioning. What we're questioning is the origin of this, of these phenomena, whether they're viral in origin, not whether they've been detected or not, whether they actually are viral in origin. And if they're not viral in origin, their provenance, then of course this lends total support to the critique of the so-called vaccines, the injections, the COVID injections, can only be dangerous. They can only ever be dangerous because the provenance of the genetic material upon they're supposedly based isn't viral at all. So it's a confection, really. It's an alchemy, a modern day alchemy. I just wanted to maybe bring Mike back in here, because Mike, your comments about the methodology and the research, the way the research has been done in virology and tracking that back across all the different viruses that Mark's mentioned, and Mark and Sam Bailey's videos are very good on this. But the background to this you've got on your website, and as a citizen coming to this, as somebody with some science training, obviously, but what's your feeling about the future, really, and what we're talking about here, using non-authority sites looking at the people like Sam and Mark Bailey that aren't mainstream doctors anymore. We're talking about reinventing our science information sources and system sources in a completely different way to before. What's your thinking about this?
Well, I'm excited about all this. I'm seeing new names and faces popping up all the time, and I think a lot of it, for myself, I was driven by the censorship. The fact that when I started off, I was doing just Facebook posts, just talking to friends and family, and trying to get the information out to a smaller group. But as more and more people found what I was posting, I started getting censored heavily. Anything that I posted about PCR, any vaccination, even if it was just directly from the FDA or the CDC or the WHO, if I gave any sort of information from these that contradict the main narrative, I was banned. I was given a 30, almost a, there was one period where I went from like in 2 days from a 24-hour ban to a 30-day ban just because of, PCR. And they don't want anything out there counter to their narrative. And so that forced me to create the blog and to get this information out there in other ways. And I think that's what we've had to do, with different doctors and we've seen scientists like Mike Donio get out there and, create Telegram channels or getting on Odyssey and BitChute and doing their own videos. And it to me is exciting because we're seeing this movement, this uprising of people that are different backgrounds. But like for myself, I consider myself just more of a normal person. I do have a science background and everything, but if I can look at this, these old virology papers and make some sense of it, anyone can. It just takes a little bit of effort. We have to be willing to not just accept what we were told, but to actually go back and research these things and look at the information for ourselves and see if it makes sense. Use some critical thinking skills, use logic and discernment and look at this information. And so anyone can get out there and do this and can help share and spread the message. And I think that's what we're seeing is a lot more people are rising up and joining groups. We're creating a community, whether it's through Telegram channels and different things. And to me, that's exciting. It's hopeful. We're getting around the censorship. And that's why I appreciate.
So in a way, sure. And so what you're saying really, well, what we're saying is that we're creating a new social movement. Is that the right word for it? That embodies citizens that are awake to the science, are self-aware, but they're actually tutoring themselves in a way with scientists like Dr. Sam and Mark Bailey, Dr. Tom Cowan, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, and all the others. And linking to Eric, what you were talking about some time ago, which is this links back to other environmental movements, doesn't it? Social movements around health and the environment and how those came about and how those embodied many of these truth issues around science, or maybe how some of these movements obstruct the issues around science. Because I think I'm sure some of you will agree that, we haven't just been censored by the mainstream. We've also been censored within the freedom and the so-called truth movement. It's been quite hard sometimes to get heard by people that we think should hear us, but they haven't. They've actually obstructed us. It may be not overtly, but maybe tacitly they've done it silently by leaving us off the agenda. Did you have any comments, Eric, to add into this?
Listening to this for a long time and this morning, I keep being reminded that this is all about what people will believe. In the end, it is what people believe. It doesn't matter how right you are or how impeccable your proof is. It doesn't matter how well you understand something. It ultimately comes down to what they believe and find believable. And that's often a person that they find believable. And we have to stay in the realm of human psychology here and not ourselves get swept up in the technology. And I know that it's very hard when you've spent years mastering the history and the technology and you're carrying all that around in your body. In my experience, as many other people involved with the toxins issue, it comes down to, for example, explaining to a person who is at potential risk of toxins that there is actually a risk that is not worth taking. And then it's going to come down to you versus the guy from the state standing there saying it's safe, and me or my soccer moms I've recruited to stand outside the dormitories when I thought, hey, why not, let's get some soccer moms to talk to these other soccer moms. And what I saw in that experiment was people just tend to believe the state authority. And so we have to get across that hurdle of belief, I think, more than anything. And what we know is that people will believe things that have their choice to believe is not on the basis of truth. This is very hard for people who spend their lives invested in studying and understanding the truth. And everyone on this panel has spent, I bet, at least 500 nights up till 4 a.m. trying to figure out the truth in the middle of all of this, because that's because we're the kind of people who do that. And it is difficult to understand that there are people who just simply don't do that. And when R2-D2 comes bumbling along, then R2-D2 is the truth. And this is why I'm saying we really need to have this conversation a lot, like playing tennis or some other thing, to get good at it and come up with engaging and funny ways to do this. And these things really stick, and they help get past the ego obstacles, the I am wrong, I have these little shocking moments of revelation. There's a fellow in the neighborhood who, it's, I have to say, for the purpose of this conversation, is gay. And the fact that he's gay means that he's at one of the people who has had to, and very smart, had to understand the AIDS problem from the standpoint of being someone who is told over and over again that he is at risk. And one day he explained to me the entire Peter Duesberg theory of what was going on with AIDS and HIV. And then a week later, when I explained to him that my latest findings had been, well, no one can actually produce this SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it looks like they've got this problem with every virus, he said, you're not going to tell me that, I'll get me to believe there's no such thing as a communicable disease. Believe. You're not going to get me to believe it. And so I think we have to understand that we are up against this arbitrary, emotional, not logical factor in the human psyche. This is part of the human condition that's about belief. And part of belief is credibility, and part of belief is understandability, part of belief is convenience, and part of belief is, what do I have to adjust if I now believe this new thing and all the old things I believed were not true? So there's a lot of factors there. There's skin in the game. People have that skin in the game. So when a parent, I've worked a lot on toxic dormitories, and signal me when I'm getting near the end of my time. And they show up, they've driven all the way from Suffolk County, New York. They've made the 3-4 hour trip up to New Paltz. Mm. It's taken them years to plan the kids' college education. And they show up on the campus, and there's some people there saying this building was contaminated in a 1991 incident. Mm. they're heavily invested in dumping their kid in that dormitory and getting back on the road and going out to dinner because it's the first day their kid is in school and it's a big day in the life of the parents. They do not want to turn around with that child, young adult, and bring them back to whatever Ronkonkoma, New York, and the entire plans of the last 2 years are scuttled. This is what we're up against. We're up against belief, which is about convenience.
We are. And you can see how this has worked in the last 2 years, where you've had the virologists, you had the microbiologists, and then you've had them wrapped in the social scientists, the psychologists, the behavioral psychologists, and the sociologists. And I think that medical sociology here is quite a key area to bring in. We do know that intellectual understanding doesn't translate into human behavior. We've known this in health for a long time. A classic thing is, you know, smoking causes illness, therefore people should stop smoking. But it's a very, very trite equation there, a bit like Nancy Reagan's idea about how you cure drug abuse. You just say no to it. And, you know, it doesn't actually work. It doesn't
actually work. Thank you, Kevin. Kevin, just on that note, if that's okay, we'll just go for a quick break on the Dolores Cahill radio show on TNTradio.live. And our guests today are Kevin Corbett and Dr. Mark Bailey, Mike Stone, and Eric Capolino. And we'll be back in 2 minutes.
TNT Radio's Jeremy Nell.
My worldview tends to be around a set of core values. And in many ways, the postmodern cultural Marxist way of approaching things is to disrupt core values. In other words, nothing means anything anymore. Question everything. You can have 546 genders. White people are evil. Black people can't be racist. And so on and so forth. The entire fabric of reality gets destroyed if you allow too much liberal thinking.
Jeremy Nell and Germ Warfare on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
You have the right to know. The right to know about culture. The right to know about the economy. The right to know about technology and to know about sports. You have the right to know about education and politics and the weather. You have the right to know what's happening abroad and in your backyard. But above all else, you have the right to know that this right is under attack and we must work to protect it. Because in order to be free, we must be informed. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
As an organ donor, your story doesn't have to end. The good in you can live on. In fact, you could save up to 8 lives and restore sight and health for many more. Sign up right now online as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. You'll be happy you did. And just maybe, someone else will be happy too. Go to organdonor.gov. It saves lives. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Silence for thinking differently? Silence for thinking differently. Not here. Silence for asking questions? Not here. Not here. Silence for discussing the other side of the story? Not on TNT Radio. Join the conversation anytime. Search TNT Radio on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Getter, or Gab. Download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show on TNT Radio, and it's hosted by Dr. Kevin Corbett. So over to you, Kevin, again.
Before the break, I was talking about how we understand that knowledge on its own doesn't change behavior. So we can prove that viruses have not been proven. We can prove that their material reality is at least questionable, if not actually there. And this on its own is a very difficult message for so many people to take, because as Mike and Eric were saying before the break, you know, when RDT2 comes along, when the authorities come along and tell you something's true, 9 out of 10 people are going to go along with that. They're going to comply. And when a scientist tells you something's true, people automatically default to believing this is correct. And you can give people knowledge, information, and it doesn't change their understanding or their behavior. And I think for the future, this is what we're going to build on, this whole issue about how do we influence people and how have we influenced people. And undoubtedly, the work that we've done in the last 2 years has undoubtedly influenced the authorities. It's influenced the truth movement, the freedom movement, and it will continue to do that through the momentum that we're building up. So it is the case that we just need to do more of what we've been doing, and we need to do it in bigger numbers. And in the last couple of years, you can see that scientists have come on board. We've had scientists like Mike Donio coming out of this. We've had others coming out of the system. I know locally in the UK, I've had many microbiologists approach me anonymously, frightened of losing their jobs. And they've been following this debate with SARS-CoV-2 and with the other viruses well before the last 2 years. So I do think that this is an important issue to really advertise the effect that we're having, which is difficult to measure, but it's not difficult to qualify. It's difficult to quantify our effect, but it's not difficult to qualify the effect we're having, and we can see this on a daily basis. The other issues here is that we're not just fighting an issue like, a science issue. It's a sociological phenomenon we're dealing with, where the regulatory frameworks, the institutions of government and healthcare are totally captured by this whole viral myth, and they're creating epidemics as much as anything. And how do we go around this when all of this ideology is being wrapped up on a daily basis in terms of travel restrictions, social interaction restrictions, masking and all the rest that's sort of gone off the boil now, but could easily come back? So I think these are the important issues that we need to think about. How our antiviral ideology, our antiviral science, actually, because we're not just basing our work on belief, it's based on science. Our antiviral science is going to impact on the wider sociological, the institutions of government and healthcare, and on our daily restrictions, which can easily become more restrictive at the drop of a hat. We're in a power situation here as much as anything else. Power and knowledge, a very interesting couplet. And the institutions of virology are quite powerful. They've infected the biotech and pharma industries undoubtedly in the last 100 years. They've become instruments of this ideology, and that's the power base that we're having to confront. But power isn't just a top-down thing. Power and the power to act are very granular and very disseminated. And we are very powerful as a group, not just as individuals, but as a network, as a community, and as a new social movement, an antiviral social movement. So I think that we ought to be looking at some issues. And I'd like to just throw the door open, really, to Mark, Mike, and Eric to make some comments on this, perhaps, before we finish up.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. And I actually think it's a really exciting time. To me, COVID-19 has been a huge overreach by the perpetrators behind this fraud. And it's actually woken up more people than I think they anticipated in 2020. And I know my fellow panelists would probably agree, it was pretty lonely when you said to people that the particle SARS-CoV-2 didn't seem to exist, even amongst very skeptical people about the whole COVID situation, that didn't really get a lot of traction. But soon we found that people were interested. They really were interested in the whole science behind virology and, in a wider sense, germ theory and the whole concepts of vaccinations as well. And we know too that the amount of censorship that we've been subjected to has been absolutely incredible. So we know the audience is there. It's just that we're getting a lot of interference from big tech and authorities with regard to how we can get that to more people. So yeah, I think it's the other thing I often ask people to do is to ask themselves, what is virology and the whole viral theory delivered for them, and getting them to reflect on that, because for most people it's brought them lockdowns, hardship in their own personal lives, whether that's for social or health or business reasons. It's brought them useless products in the forms of vaccines, which are not only pointless but dangerous. Pharmaceutical products, similarly, which do not help and only make people sicker. So if people really start to reflect what has actually been given to them in their health and well-being from this whole entity we call virology, I think it's easy for most people to see that it's not a whole lot at all. So yeah, I think exciting times in a lot of ways. And I actually think I think it's probably closer than we think to the whole house of cards falling down, because I think unlike in the 80s and 90s, and you'll be well and truly familiar with this, Kevin, with the HIV AIDS discussions that were going on then, it was very specific. It involved a much smaller group of people. The conversation was not really spilling out into a wider audience. And despite the fact that some incredibly important discussions went on, particularly with the likes of the Perth Group and Stefan Lanka and other great scientists who were speaking out at that time, for the average person on the planet, it wasn't something that affected them. AIDS and the concept of this fictional virus, HIV, were just a distant concept which didn't seem to have much relevance to most people. However, with the last three decades, we've seen these pseudo pandemics, these productions get bigger and bigger until they've just involved more and more people, until the COVID-19 pseudo pandemic, which has basically engulfed the entire planet. Now, although the perpetrators, this has been what they've been planning for some time for population, it's been a giant wake up call, because now everybody's affected. And that's why you'll see people like myself and Sam, Mike Stone, Eric, Kevin, Andy Kaufman, Tom Cowan, Christine Massey, and all of the other activists out there. We're saying, okay, this has gone way too far. This is not some hobby industry. That this is something that's destroying the planet, basically, or destroying humanity as we know it. So, yeah, I think the critical mass, it's almost here. And I think we can see by the analytics on our websites, et cetera, that the audience is not getting smaller. It's getting bigger. More and more people are getting interested in this stuff. And like Eric said, although for us, it's an old conversation now, for many people, it's a new conversation. And we just have to get out there each week and keep on doing what we're doing.
And Eric, what did you like to say about this in relation to what we've just talked about?
I want to talk about getting over the hump of the belief issue. I think it's very important. And I get this from A Course in Miracles, partly, which talks about how belief is the kind of final filter, and you've really got to work with that. In the early 20s, I started drilling into this issue, and my assignment was the test. I knew that everything was coming back to this test, so I focused all my energy on that, and well, not all of it, but like 60% of it. And then by the end of the year, I understood all the major, even by when I look at my notes and my articles in May, I understood all the issues. And some of them, I went back and looked at my March 2020 publications, and I understood all the issues in March of 2020. It's all there in March of 2020. But I still couldn't let go of the idea that there was some form of a virus. This is a very powerful thought form. It is God for most people, or it is the God particle for most people. And this is a usurpation of another natural concept. And so I had all the information I needed. I completely understood what was going on. I had been in touch with someone very close to the retraction paper. all through 2020. I was warned in advance it was coming out. I had all the information I needed. Nobody was convincing me of anything. I was involved in a dialogue to extract the information with a biochemist in Italy. In any event, by November, I still believed there was a virus. And I wake up one morning, I get a phone call, and I'm asked to show up with all my gear at this place in the middle of nowhere where Cowan and Calvin were going to speak together for the first time. So it was around this hour of the morning. I'm gathering all my stuff in various places mixed in with guitar amplifiers to get to this thing on time where there's going to be 130 people in this place with no distancing and no masks against lockdown. And it was only from that day's experience of being in the room after 8-9 months of this insanity that I completely let go of the concept of a virus. And I stopped saying it's not COVID.
What you're saying, Eric, it wasn't the intellectual back and forth on videos and reading journal articles. For you, the penny dropped, the key moment for you of awakening was actually in the moment with real people in the real environment.
Yeah, and the weeks after where no one got sick. And by the way, I never believed anybody's video. Cowan and Kaufman did not explain the virus issue to me. David Bettini did in a long Socratic dialogue where I fought and wrestled with everything. No one gave me this. I built this. And even after all of that work, I absolutely understood the issues. But there was still this belief lurking around in my mind that I had to physically, biologically disprove by going to a place with 130 people acting normally, hugging and kissing and eating food and chowing down and little kids running around in a big potluck dinner. And then nothing happened. Nothing. It was like the scene from Dr. Strangelove where who's the British warrant officer? Who turns on the radio? You've got to collect all the radios.
Yes.
And why does he have to collect all the radios? Because if Washington, D.C. had been nuked, it would be on the radio. So he turns it on, and there's just music. And he goes back to the general who's pushed the button, and he says, "Well, I thought you'd be happy to know that they're God damn it.
Yes.
Put that down. Put that."
I mean, maybe that's
Captain
an issue.
Whatever, get rid of that radio. So
maybe that's an issue there, you know, for Mike, because, you know, Mike, the analytics on your website, virology.com, must be phenomenal because the hits. But I'm sure that you go beyond just the website. You engage with the users and you have a back and forth and you have a real dialogue with people that isn't just virtual. And that's I think what Mark was saying a minute ago about, you know, AIDS and HIV affected 40 years ago a smaller demographic, a smaller group of people. And now this is SARS-CoV-2 has just blown the whole viral thing out in the open. And everybody's becoming a dissident to a greater or lesser extent. You know, everybody is not going along with it to a greater or lesser extent. So the amount of critical thinking now is exponential compared to the 1980s with HIV. I don't know whether you've experienced this with your website.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, I've seen, that's actually one of the things that I'm really happy with is just from doing this blog, it's created kind of a community of its own within the blog in the comments. And just, you know, there's a lot of people that are very supportive or finding the work and coming to this realization through there. But, you know, I'll get some people that maybe agree with some of what I say and disagree with other things. And, you know, well, I like to have a dialogue with people because I think not just for myself, but for others. It can open up different avenues to explore these issues with, and maybe even bring about a better or deeper understanding. And you know, I've had a few different discussions with some people. I won't name names, but that I've had feedback from other people who found just these discussions, where, you know, it was kind of a debate, so to speak, on some of the articles, and they were enlightened just from those conversations. And they thought of things differently. And I find with my interactions with people, it can lead me to, you know, do different research that I might not have been brought on to at the moment. And it makes me dig down deeper. But yeah, it's been amazing seeing this community grow, just not on the blog, but, you know, we have some groups on Facebook, the Infectious Myth group, which is an awesome group of like-minded individuals who get together and we share ideas with each other. On Telegram, we have groups and we discuss these things back and forth. So you can definitely see a community really growing, and we're coming together, which is amazing. And so, yeah, it's been very exciting from my outside perspective.
Would you all agree then that in a way we are part of a new social movement, if that's the right word? And by social, I don't mean, you know, I mean, in a broad sense, includes scientists, includes people looking at deconstructing virology, looking at rebuilding science, I think, in a new way, based on truth and based on the accepted tenets of science, accepted basis, accepted axioms, the postulates which have been ignored in virology. And is it possible that we could rebuild a new health science here that is, because we've got the components there already. It's all there. Yeah. You have the scientists, you have the health scientists, you have the practitioners, you have the activists, and very often those labels, those categories are all overlapping because we've all had some science training. We all are working as activists as well as scientists and as practitioners in our own way. So in a way, we embody all these functions within a social movement. What do you think about this? Would we call it an antiviral social movement? Or what sort of term, what sort of name would we give this new social movement?
I like that name.
Spiritual movement, Mike. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I like that antiviral name. I completely agree that, we're getting out there. And it's not so much, I mean, you could look at it like we're creating or trying to establish a new science. But I think also I look at it more just getting back to the basics, you know, the science that's been ignored, the scientific method, and holding them to actually performing science the way it was meant to be. And they're not doing that.
So what you're saying, Mike, is it's more of a scientific renaissance,
Yes.
That we're talking about here.
Kevin, I was thinking of calling it like an integrity movement or integrity project, right? You know, if someone says something, they just have to be challenged and then put it in a repository and let it be checked in the world. So it's to bring integrity back to science and research.
And what do you think, Mark and Eric? Eric, you've got your hand up. What do you think about this?
I mean, very briefly, I want to leave a minute for Mark to speak. People need to feel better. I think that there's a lot about just feeling better. And I think that this is really, that's what this is going to come down to. It's tough to be alive right now. There's so many assaults and so much stress and so much pain. And we need to feel better. And I think if we can focus on that, we've got something. And isn't this what doctors are supposed to help us with in the first place, is feeling better?
And Mark, what did you think about that?
I want to feel better, doctor. What do I do?
I used to be in the medical system, and it's not the place you go for health, to be honest. I think the medical system does its own thing. It's self-serving. Health is actually really simple. And one of the frustrations Sam and I have with the work we're doing at the moment is that we spend so much time dismantling the bad medical science that we'd love to spend more time just talking to our audience about how to be healthy. And it's actually really simple. It basically comes down to diet, psychological and spiritual considerations. There's really not a lot more to it. It's very simple. Now, our household, we've got three children, And we embrace a very holistic health lifestyle and are all incredibly healthy. And we'd like to definitely share with the world how we do that. And it's actually quite simple. One thing we've got in the pipeline is we are rebooting a book by a New Zealand doctor from the 1930s and the 1940s, which was heavily suppressed and not welcomed by the medical community. So Sam and I have decided to publish the book once again, and it is just an absolutely outstanding publication for
What's
anyone.
What's it called? We just have the last minute, Mark. What's the book called?
The book was originally called Hints on Healthy Living by Ehrlich Williams. He changed the title, and we're probably going to change it again for the sixth edition, which hopefully will be out soon.
But great.
Yeah, my great. Take on it is you don't need a lot of medical science to be healthy. It's much more simple than you think.
Great, great. So we're just going to have to leave it there. And I would like to sincerely thank Kevin Corbett, Dr. Kevin Corbett, for hosting the show. It was wonderful. And also our guests from New Zealand, Dr. Mark Bailey, and from America, Mike Stone and Eric Coppolino. And thank you also, Kevin. Thank you very much to everyone.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, team. Bye now.
Bye-bye, everyone. Thank you.